I'm Jerry Barney, and I'm leading now the first of a new week of sessions devoted to the subject of the future of the Earth. This past week, I gave five talks on some of the things that are happening to the Earth that will shape its future, particularly things having to do with what is called development and how that's going to or may provide more economic justice for people around the world, and also things having to do with security, particularly the idea that security can come through armaments. And we talked in particular about the fact that armaments, particularly nuclear armaments, have reached the level where the human species could now so severely damage the life support systems of the planet as to extinguish the human species, and how this has put a special responsibility.
Can you speak louder if you can?
How this has put a special responsibility on all of us, in effect, to create the Earth day by day, and just simply seeing that it is not destroyed.
Is the mic on? I don't know.
It's only a taping mic.
Well, there is also...
We have it hooked up. It should be hooked up to the speakers.
It, does not appear to be hooked up to the speakers. Maybe we'll wait a minute and see if we can make this happen.
Okay.
Is that there now? Someone knows how to do this. Well, this week I'm going to try to talk more about the future of the Earth in terms of the church and the church's role in shaping that, and the role of us as individual Christians. And tonight is going to be, in a way, kind of an overview. And what I would like to do, or what I will do, is try to explain the future of the Earth in terms of the Christmas story. That's our story. And in a way, it's also very, in a very real way, the story of the future. I want to tell the story in a way that's perhaps a little bit different than what you've heard before. I'm going to draw on the two sources of information that God has given us about himself and about the creation, and that is revelation and also a simple observation of the creation itself. Now, it all begins, of course, with the Word. You know, before there was anything, there was the Word. And we know that from revelation, from insight, I guess you would say, into God. But with the Word and from observation of the creation, we know that the Word caused something to happen that was really extraordinary. There was an explosion of proportions that are hard to describe. Now, billions of years after the fact, you can still hear the echoes of that explosion vibrating through the emptiness of space. And that's a big explosion to be heard billions of years later. And physicists who have been studying the evolution of the cosmos look back to that time and are aware now that there's really nothing to see on the other side of that explosion. And they're also finding that it is possible, in fact it occurs on a regular basis, that the nothing leads to things, that the things can be created out of nothing. And that apparently is how the Word created all that there is. Now, as we have looked at the creation, you see some rather interesting things. We've, as scientists, have tried to understand the creation in part by taking things apart. And we first discovered that many things are made out of what we now call chemicals, and that the chemicals, when taken apart, are made out of elements. And the elements, when you take those apart, are made out of nuclei and electrons. And that even the nuclei can be taken apart into protons and neutrons. And if you try hard enough, you can even take those apart and get into much smaller things. When I was a graduate student, there was a little poem. I don't know who came up with it originally, but it was to describe the perplexity of the theoretical physicist, who said, big fleas have little fleas upon their backs to bite them, and little fleas have lesser fleas, and so on ad infinitum. And that's really what we're continuing to discover, that the harder we look to find the elemental, that it turns out it's not the elemental, that there's something smaller. And in some ways, the smaller things prove to be of even more energy. It's a very complex and very confusing situation that we've run into in trying to understand the creation. But some of the things that emerge are really quite interesting. We've discovered, for example, that things that appear to be particles can also be waves. And that there is, it's a paradox for which there is no answer. The way the creation is that there are things that are both particles and waves, and you wonder how that can be. And it is, I think, a nice paradigm to try to understand something that can be three things. The Trinity I'm thinking of. But there's more. We discover that the harder you look at things and the more detail you look at them, you discover you can't find, if you know exactly how where a particle is, you can't know how fast it's going. And we've also discovered that all of these things seem to be tied together, in a way every particle in the universe seems to be influenced by every other. That the universe is, in fact, like a fabric, you could think of it, all woven together in which every particle is affecting every other in a space that's very unlike what we're able to perceive. We can perceive three dimensions fairly well. And if we really stretch our minds, we can begin to imagine a fourth dimension of time. But from what we have studied and learned of the universe, we know that God created a universe that, at a minimum, has 14 dimensions to it. And it's hard to even imagine something that's 14-dimensional. But that's the way the creation is. Now, another thing, an interesting thing that happened with that big explosion caused by the Word, is it set off a process that, to my thinking, is somewhat akin to something I did when I was young and didn't really know yet how to play dominoes, and I'd stack them up, and I'd make snakes and all kinds of things, and push one over, and it'd be a chain reaction of things happening. In a way, that's what the Word did also. The Word not only created all of the things that are the universe, in terms of elementary particles, but also created all of the forces among them and set in motion a process that's something very much like those dominoes all falling over. And as time has gone on, we in this lodge and this planet are part of the end result. There's that simple act of the Word being spoken in the beginning created all of this out of nothing. and led to that that creative process that continues today. Now, a part of that that creative process has been the creation of the human species. As best we can tell by looking at the creation, that happened fairly late in the whole process. And after the human species came along, there came to be something that we now know and understand as evil. In fact, even in the Genesis account, there is a discussion of evil. It's not made very clear where evil came from, and I think that's something that Lutheran theologians and scientists continue to wonder about. But both from revelation and from observation of the creation, it's pretty clear that there are such things as evil, and that they have a very pervasive influence. Now, as far as our story is concerned, as Christians, we know, we understand that at some point, evil began to influence the behavior of human beings. And in the process, when that happened, we often refer to it as eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But there came to be a separation between us and God, a distancing, and that it was an uncomfortable thing. We became aware of death. We gained the knowledge that we would all die. We also became aware of our nakedness. It's always struck me as interesting that the very first thing that Adam and Eve became aware of after eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil was their nakedness. But another thing happened shortly thereafter, and that was God promised that at some point there would be a reconciliation. And that's what the Christmas story is all about. It's about the Word. Remember the source of that enormous explosion, the Word becoming flesh and dwelling among us. And with that, with the arrival of the Christ, with God appearing in human form, that reconciliation that we were waiting for took place. It was not an easy matter. There was a lot of temptation through Christ's life. And there was a lot that we learned from Christ's life as well. But to my thinking, the thing that perhaps ought to be celebrated more than it certainly is Good Friday. Now, the thing we usually celebrate is Easter, but the culmination of the sacrifice that was necessary to reconcile us with Christ was really Good Friday. And we've read some of the accounts of the temptation of Christ, but I have to believe that the last times, the last days of Christ, the last hours of Christ, must have been a period of extreme temptation. It's a fact that God sent his only Son to be tortured for us. Tortured in two ways, you know, physically tortured, being ultimately suffocated on the cross, weakened to the point where you cannot support yourself, to the point you can even breathe. But tortured also in the sense of being abandoned by God, of taking the sins of all of us upon himself, and suffering the total rejection of God, the abandonment of God, at the very time when the temptations must have been greatest. And it seems to me that the thing that would be appropriate for a celebration of Good Friday is is almost like the cheering squad for the high school football team, urging Christ on. Try to hang on. Try to do what God has asked you to do. Try to overcome the temptation to come down from the cross. And he did, you know. And it was a wonderful victory for us. And it seems to me that an appropriate response at 3 p.m. in the afternoon on Good Friday might be to cheer, say, he did it. Who would have believed a human being could do the things that Christ did for us? So we celebrate Easter. We celebrate it for the same reason, or I think out of tradition, because the things that happened on that first Easter and that first Good Friday were such a shock to people. They hadn't expected Christ to die at all. They understood him and as the Messiah who was going to be different, they thought, than the Messiah turned out to be. But Easter was really the resurrection was the reassurance of those first Christians. It was not the event that really made the difference, but it was a great reassurance to them, and something where I can certainly understand why they would celebrate it. And it's nice to celebrate it. I agree. But I continue to think that the thing that really is important for us is that event that took place on Good Friday. That's the thing that really, that's the event that really provided the reconciliation. So, where are we now? Christ has come, lived, and died, and we're awaiting a second coming. That hasn't come yet, and as Dan has pointed out last week in his study of Ephesians, the Ephesians were living at a time when they, just shortly after the death of Christ, and they were expecting him to come back any time. And in the first 10, 20 years he didn't return. And they thought, well, maybe sometime in the next decade. He didn't return then either. And they were beginning to feel very troubled about all this, and gradually coming to a sense that they were in, as he put it, for the long haul, that it was going to be a time before Christ returned. I think we're in a similar sort of situation to the Ephesians, that we're discovering something that we hadn't expected. What we're discovering is not only that it wasn't going to be the first decade or even the first century when Christ returns, but it may be a good while. But we're also discovering that in a way God has played a dirty trick on us. We've expected somehow that everything was in God's hands, and that our job was to go and preach, teach, tell people the good news, and leave everything else to God. And we're beginning to discover that in fact is not the case, that God has made human beings, made us all, in a way, co-creators with him. You can look around us and see the ways in which we are participating in the shaping of the future of the creation. You can see, for example, that we're deciding which species should live and not live. You can see that we're developing technology that will allow us to decide when new species should be introduced into the creation. You can see us deciding collectively when and how the entire environment, the entire atmosphere of the planet should be altered and modified to shape the future climate of the planet. You can see us deciding when and how the soils, the source of fertility for the planet, should be eroded and put into the seas. You can see us deciding when the chemical composition of the waters, the whole planet, should be changed by acid precipitation and things of that sort. But probably the ultimate dirty trick played by God on us is that God made the creation in such a way that the creation itself, the very substance of the creation, contains energy that is so powerful that it can destroy the creation. And by eating a little deeper of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, we've discovered that fact for ourselves. And we now possess the knowledge to use that energy in an extremely destructive way and to destroy the whole planet, thereby ending the creative process. So in a very literal and very real way, the story of the creation, the Christmas story in a way too, is that each day now is a day that we have to thank God for, and a day that God creates and that we create with God by deciding not to destroy the planet. And we're going to have to go on with that. The knowledge that we have gained is not something that's ever going to go away. You could take the bombs apart, but the factories would still be there. You could take the factories apart, but the universities would still be there. The only way to eliminate the knowledge of how to build nuclear weapons is to eliminate all of the people who know. And even in this room here, there are several people who know how to build those weapons. We're always going to know how. So we're going to have to learn how to handle that information and to create the future day by day by not destroying the future. So that's a little bit different kind of perception than we have had in the past, I think. And like the Ephesians, it's going to take us some time to really adjust to that awareness and understanding that we, with God, are co-creators of the future. But with it comes some interesting opportunities. And I'd like now, in a way, to say that I think Lutherans have something really kind of special to offer. We haven't got everything, all a corner of all the knowledge, but I do think we have something kind of special that emerged out of the Reformation, and I'd like to give you kind of a capsulized summary of the Reformation Day sermon that I have never yet heard, and I hope someday I will. There's always in a Reformation Day sermon some allusion to John 3:13 or 3:16, that God so loved the world, and that's certainly a very important part of our tradition. That we stand forgiven. What I'd like to see in a Reformation Day sermon is to say, repeat John 3:16, and then say, the one thing we know about, the one thing that we can be absolutely sure of, is that we don't have to worry about going to heaven. That's settled. That was settled on Good Friday. What's left for us to do now? That's the question. We're not going to earn our way to heaven. The ticket to heaven is given to us free and clear. But what's left to do with a life when that matter has already been settled? it seems to me that what's left is to help God, to work with God, to get on to redeem the creation. That our task as Christians in this age is to say that we must, with God, work to redeem this creation. And that doesn't just mean going out and inviting people to come to church. It means developing some sense, some real vision of what a redeemed creation would look like, and then being a part of making that happen. I have a Buddhist friend. Don't know him well. I've talked to him on the phone a time or two. He's won a Pulitzer Prize for some of his poetry here in the U.S. Gary Snyder is his name. And there's a book of interviews that's published with interviews of him. And it's entitled The Real Work. And in reading that and also reading some of Snyder's poems, I think he has, from a Buddhist faith, arrived at something that's very close to my understanding of what it is to be a Christian today. And that's what he calls the real work. In essence, Snyder's view of the real work for himself and his friends and others is to get on with making the planet what it could be. Now, God created this planet in such a way that it could be managed with a whole lot more justice than it has now. And if we really put our hearts and minds to it, I think we can bring out some of that potential and move forward with redeeming the planet. And it's important, I think, also to understand that in terms of our baptism. You know, we talk about baptism as the time in which we're marked by the cross of Christ forever. And usually we think about that as being somehow an invisible mark that's put upon us, so that at Judgment Day, when we arrive at the pearly gates, they swing right open and in we go. But I think the real meaning of that phrase, marked by the cross of Christ forever, is a twofold one. Part of it certainly has to do with being forgiven, being reconciled with God. But the other is that when you're baptized, there is a Spirit of God that comes upon you that's going to make a troubled person out of you for the rest of your life. You're going to be in situations all of your life in which you're in confrontation with principalities and powers. You're going to struggle all your life. You're going to be rejected. There's going to be suffering and struggle all of your life. But that's what the real work is. So I'd like to see that Reformation Day sermon conclude with telling the whole parish, it's now time for you to get outside the four walls of this parish building, out into the world, and making steps toward seeing that this creation is reformed, this is redeemed. That's what we need to be about. It's far more important that people be out living lives that are really creative than it is that we have a full quota of ushers every Sunday. We need people out in the world. That's what Christianity is about today. That's what we need to be called to do. So that, I think, is the story of Christmas. That's what we're about. God created a magnificent creation. And evil entered into it. We've had separation. Christ has come. That's the event that we're celebrating today. And Christ died. He accomplished what he came to do on Good Friday. And like the Ephesians, we're discovering that it's not simply a matter of sitting back and waiting, but we've got some work to do. And as I say, that's our story. It tells who we are. I'd say that the essence of who we are today is that we are Christ rising, the body of Christ rising. So that's my story, and I want to stop there and see what you think. Well, I'm not sure how good a Buddhist my friend is. He might be a Christian. Not one to admit it, really. I'm not sure that he and I would come to a full agreement about what evil is. I'm not even sure I understand it perfectly. I'm quite sure I don't. I don't even understand what good is perfectly, I have to say. But what Gary has done is to think through what he thinks is an appropriate way to live. And I think there's a great deal of merit in his ideas about how to live and what's important. And the concept of there being work, the kind of thing you do just to support yourself, and a real work, it's something that you're doing for God. And it's not necessarily just something you do on Sundays. It's a way you live your life. It's a lifestyle. It's a commitment. There's something that goes far beyond what you do on Sundays. And that's where I find myself liking very much what I hear from him. Rudy, you had your hand up.
Well, I like to look at this as God being the provider, really, of all of creation, and also the provider of the human family. And he has endowed the human family with an understanding of the creation that is greater than any other part of the creation. And we have a covenant relationship, in a sense, with God, being in the image of God, or however you wish to state it, that impels us into a position that we are the stewards. We are charged with the responsibility. We're the managers, if you wish to put it that way.
The tillers and keepers.
Tillers and the keepers. And unless we are willing to caress the earth and love it, as God states, he so loved the world that Christ came, and that we have the whole pattern that we profess as Christians. If we do not live up to that, then we're, as Joe Sittler puts it, we're simply blaspheming the creation. And we're destroying what God has created. And unless we can come to terms with that as a family, put in the garden, which is the earth, and take care of it, we must inevitably suffer the consequences of natural laws and whatever else. We can't expect to go on simply using and not putting back. And this is our pattern. Whether it's the soil, we use the soil. We do not put things back in the same amount that we take it out. We're injuring the atmosphere, we're injuring our water sources, and all of that, and unless we come to grips with that, we can't look at a very long relationship with this creation. Maybe we aren't destined to stay with it unless we get our act in order.
Yeah.
how to put it in the framework, or rephrase what he said a little bit differently. The framework from which I hear it often is that we should instead of the word creation, the word that comes out, people of the United States, that is, instead of redeeming creation, it's redeeming the people of the United States. So go beyond that and say the people of the world, and then go beyond that and say the earth, and even beyond that as we begin to explore outside of the earth. So it's all of creation, not just people of the United States. And it has an extremely different impact on what we do. And Vern made a comment. I think, for me, that what we're about is more than problem solving. That's part of it. But that doesn't contain certain aspects of what it means to live that are involved in the everyday life with your family and other people. And I think it's actually, for me, it's even a mystery of life itself. Problem solving is a part of it, and God has revealed some of that mystery in Christ's life. Make that comment too. I'm not quite sure how to describe that. Evil to me is also a mystery. I don't understand evil, but I know it's present, and I felt it. I continue to feel it.
The vision of what the world would be like, what it ought to be like, I think it, you know, Jesus, in announcing the kingdom of God, gives the vision and even some samples. I think that the task, as you pointed out, is to contemporize that vision for our day. But there's a tremendous drawback in that most of the decisions that we have to make for our survival, be they ecological, economic, or political, are very rational decisions. And the whole world is moving away from rational kinds of thinking. That the kind of thinking that has built Western civilization, if you will. And saying that it can't be trusted and that we ought to operate more on a feeling or intuitive level, and the facts be damned. Now, it's a very lonely voice when people try to appeal to a rational kind of way of approaching the world, the global problems. And particularly in the church, where people operate with such a dichotomy, and saying, I have the real world out here and the rational world, what I want from the church is a spiritual experience. Because I have to deal with too much rationality as it is. And so the church, in order to ensure its own survival, has to fulfill people's, quote, spiritual experiential needs, unless they want to go to a rock concert, or in doing that, has to then get people to participate in the more rational kind of global issues that you talk about. And people get very upset. And so at the same time, you're trying to get people to think rationally about the world's problems, you alienate them in that process. And you end up speaking to an audience of one. As the Doonesbury cartoon did when, what was it, Reverend Scott, he was talking about these great issues, and there was one person there. So it's a real dilemma for the church. It's not easy at all. And I believe we're in for the long haul.
Yeah, I have a problem distinguishing on something. What's right and wrong? Now, I've been reading all about the greenhouse effect this summer. And one of the solutions to that is possibly nuclear energy. And we have two major power plants, billion-dollar power plants, that are not going to open on the East Coast. Instead, they're going to burn more fossil fuels and pollute the air more. How do we know what's nuclear, I know, is not without problems. But it isn't always clear where to act. I mean, I come from the Twin Cities. They're building a $1 billion garbage burner. And we've got a whole band of burner crowd. And then you got the county board saying this is the way of the future, and we can't put everything in the ground. What is right? How do we know? Are we leaping before we have the technology to know where we're going? Is that a problem?
It seems to me what you said in your physicist language is that God took precisely the risk which has just been described. God created man and gave man power to make a choice without knowing which way man was going to go. And because we are made in the image of God, it seems to me that we've inherited that blessing or curse, whichever it is, to have the power, competence to make decisions that we don't know what's going to happen. And God's asking us to take the same kind of risk that God took. Now that's very scary to me. But I find some consolation, if you forgive me for doing so. Now I'm going to lapse into the only language that I know, since I'm trained as a lawyer, not as a physicist. I agree with Rudy's notion that, and your statement, Jerry, that God has made available reconciliation between God and man, subject to what Rudy called a covenant. A covenant in modern day speech is usually taken to mean a contract, and that is exactly what it does not mean in law, and it hasn't meant that, as I understand it, in theology, long before the Old Testament. A covenant is a one-sided promise. I promise you that I will do this for you on the condition that. And that condition is a fact which happens or doesn't happen, which makes the promise collectible. Now that condition is never a promissory undertaking in a one-sided promise. There's no exchange. There's no bargain. God doesn't say, I will reconcile you to me if you give me this, which I want in return. Rather, God says, I will reconcile you if. And that if is terribly important because it's not a burden. It's a fact. And the fact is that one is willing to accept God on the basis that God created us, that is, willing to take risks, to accept that freedom, and to do what you're asking, as I see it. It isn't that we're going to be damned or saved if we win the battle and prevent the greenhouse effect. The reconciliation with God is sure if we accept the responsibility which God gives us. That is to engage in what I hear you calling kind of a continuing co-creation. And that's a very exciting idea.
Thank you.
We can't overlook the kind of thing that the person over there was talking about, where, as you say, we live in a universe of at least 14 dimensions. And if people in here like me and can think three dimensions and talk about time and know something about what that means, right away you see how much beyond our understanding reality and the universe consists of. And the uncertainties that we understand
are uncertain enough, but the uncertainties that we can't even comprehend or imagine, which are also there, leave a lot of room for something to happen that, as much as we want to manage things, or even if we have the best of intentions to manage in the correct direction and can get ourselves together to do that, that gap between what we can conceive of and understand and control and what we can't even imagine has got to create problems with the kind of management that we might intend.
I was thinking of the phrase, I forgot where it was, maybe it was this morning, but that reminds me of, and I'll say it again, was it the most often, the phrase that is used most often in the New Testament is, do not be afraid. Yeah. Yes, again, the risk. Even though you're in that situation, you've got a risk. I was going to comment. I was bothered by what you said. I think there is the separation of spirituality, which somehow comes from the church, church building or whatever, and is separate from the other things that we do. I have found that a catch-22. That in fact, spirituality comes from your life, how you live, total, from your work, what you're about, not necessarily from times of meditation, times in your prayer, praying, but it's your total life movement as spirituality. And if you try to separate your life from, you know, location, from, in quote, spirituality, whatever it is, that you'll be unhappy. That's not, at least that's
what I agree. I was just saying, this is what I've, you know, what I've observed is that the direction is more stuff. I mean, it shouldn't be that, but that's
what you see.
That's what we see. That's why you see the growth of fundamentalism. And we don't, unlike Islam, for example, we as Christians do not provide a cohesive plan for the way life ought to be governed.
I guess I'm just a little bit maybe bothered by the emphasis on the risk, though. Because I think that in a lot of ways, we, given all these unknowns of the cosmos that are way beyond our understanding, we in a lot of ways are like children in our understanding of the universe and of the cosmos. And just like as adults, when we deal with children, we try to help them become aware of things that if they risk and they don't know what they're getting into, they could very much damage their life. They could destroy their life. They could end up being hurt for the next, you know, several years of their life. I think that we in a lot of ways have complicated ourselves, you know, right out of the bounds of maybe taking safe risks, and to have that kind of power of the arms race as a potential that we could use, it's almost a risk, but I think we're it's a little bit beyond our capacity in a lot of ways, and unless we really continue to try to discern how to use that and use that for the good of all of humanity, then I think that, you know, we could still rationalize all different uses for it, but especially concerning the arms race and the kind of power that has, we're using that for destructive means, destroying the lives of other people. So it's like, to me, that the ideas of risk, though, I kind of pushes maybe a couple of my buttons, because it seems almost that we've already risked ourselves into a very risky position already, and I don't know if we can afford to just keep looking at it as God is calling us to risk, and I really don't see it that way at all.
Yeah. I'd like to hear a little bit more about your theology of God needing our help. Tie that into the gentleman over here, who I heard suggested, maybe I don't understand the language much you refer to, but we are co-creators with God. I'm a long, long way from ever accepting that version.
Well,
this is literally true. Also, I think and I have a fear that the general public and people are too ready to put this into the hands of the scientists, the elite. And we as scientists are only in a position to know more, but we also take the risk. And unless the general public becomes educated, this is a problem that's too big for science. And it must incorporate the church, the school, the educational system, and we must educate ourselves and our youngsters that are to be the leaders of what is the future of the earth. And I don't see this happening. I don't see it happening in the church. We're not taking a leadership role. The schools cannot handle it entirely. It's a family problem, and the family is the human family. And we had better realize it on that dimension, or I think we won't get far with it.
Well, I think I ought to respond to this in a little bit, and also to formally bring the session to a close, and then we'll, of course, go on with any other questions you have. But it seems to me there are at least three major themes and issues that have emerged from the discussion. There's the question of rationality and how important that is in just maintaining church membership today. And another is spirituality and the need to, as Vern was pointing out, to meet the spirituality need. Another has to do with risk. Now, there's not time tonight to respond to all of these things, but let me say that in the next 2 days, I'm going to lead a session called The Future of the Creation with a focus on the perish of the future. And in that, I'm going to talk about both spirituality and rationality and where they fit in my view, the perish of the future. I'm also going to lead a session on what I call a Christian think tank. And in that session, we'll be talking a lot about risk and some of the questions you're concerned with about the co-creator responsibility, the role. But just to kind of, in a nutshell, try to sum up what I'm putting for you tonight, it is that for quite a long time, I think we have, as Christians, let's say, and maybe perhaps especially as Lutherans, given too much attention to concern for the individual soul. God, of course, is concerned with the individual soul. But you know, if you understand, if you believe what Luther taught and what John 3:16 says and implies, the matter of individual salvation gets settled pretty quickly if you believe. And what's left is an entire lifetime that has to be devoted to something. And if you're not going to try to earn your salvation, as the Catholic does, and if you're assured that the one thing you know as a result of Good Friday is that your sins are forgiven, what do you do with that life? I hear the God I know calling us today to work toward the redemption of his creation. And that has to be something far more profound than inviting everybody on your block to go to church. It's got to be thinking about the complex questions that I heard over here about the garbage burners. It's got to be thinking about the ozone layer and the carbon dioxide and the greenhouse effect and all of those things. And I'd say at present, the institution of the church is not well prepared to help on those things. And that somehow, the parts of the church, the lay members of the church, need to help a great deal more in the church leadership to move us to the point where we can collectively say something far more profound about that and be involved in far more profound ways than we are today. So let's adjourn formally at this point, and any